I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education here at the Modern, and I'm really happy to be a part of this new program we're calling Sundays with the Modern. Every Sunday, 1 o'clock, you come and get a different perspective from an artist, an architect, an art historian, any sort of art scholar that we can find within the very talented metroplex of North Texas. And they may speak on the special exhibition, as Eric is going to do today, or they may speak on the permanent collection or some aspect of the architecture. So I really invite you to come every week and take your chances, or get online and see which ones you're interested in. We'll look for you to come back and see us. Next week is going to be Matthew Sonheimer. Today we have Eric Swenson here. I'm so happy to have him back. I invited him to do this, and the email back said, "I will take your challenge." So I love that response. It makes me look forward to what's going to happen today.
Did I say that?
Just a little bit about Eric. He graduated from UNT with a BFA in 1999, which was, of course, the tenure of Vernon Fisher. One of the reasons that I've asked Eric to do this today, the other being, of course, that he's a talented artist with work in this exhibition, maybe one of the most popular pieces in the exhibition that I think most of you know, the untitled fawn or whatever animal it might be with the cape. Eric was at UNT during the Good Bad Collective, really when it kind of reached its strength. He was part of that group. And many have said that was a very successful form of graduate school for a lot of these artists, and in fact it must be, because many of them have gone on to be quite successful. The first time I saw Eric's work and was blown away was at Angstrom Gallery in 1998, so before he'd even finished at UNT. It was a solo exhibition, obviously a movie. Now he's represented by Dun & Brown Contemporary in Dallas, and the James Cohen Gallery, which is both in New York and Shanghai, China. He has shown internationally almost since graduation, with exhibitions in Australia, Switzerland, China, the UK. He was in USA Today, at the Saatchi Gallery in London. And then in 2001, he was in the New Orleans Triennial. This is just naming a few of his big hits. And then in 2004, he was in the Whitney Biennial. And also in 2004, he received the Joan Mitchell Prize grant. And then in 1999, when he was just graduating from UNT, he received the Kimbrough Prize. He is now in the collection, to name a few, the Saatchi Collection, the DMA, of course, here, and the Whitney. So, you know, we could go on all day, but I'm going to turn it over to Eric. So if you would, please join me in welcoming Eric Swenson.
Thank you. Oh, no. Okay. Look, I guess we should go into the show, maybe, if you want. So, thanks for coming. Yesterday I was driving to work. It was a Saturday, is that right? Hello? Okay. So, I was driving to work and it was a Saturday. And it was a Saturday. So it was OU weekend, and I was driving, and I would cross this intersection. There was a lot of people there. and they all had their Texas shirts and OU shirts. And I'm not a fan of football or either one of those teams. So I said, come on, people, get out of the way. I've got to get to work. But I looked down, and lo and behold, I had a maroon truck on, or driving a maroon truck, and I looked down at my T-shirt, and it was an OU T-shirt. So I said, oh no, I look like a super fan right now. And I got this shirt out of a drawer. I couldn't even tell you what it is. It's very comfortable. So there was a connection to be made there, or the right circumstances got together and sort of made me into something I wasn't at that time. And I don't think I've ever really liked football, except for there was a time when my father was in the military. We were stationed in Colorado. So everyone who lives in Colorado has to be a Denver Broncos fan. And I guess maybe when my mother was probably what got me into being a Denver Broncos fan. I never really knew why I was a Denver Broncos fan. And so she would jump out of her chair and go, woohoo. And so therefore, for about 10 years after that, I would get really excited about the Denver Broncos. And they would always go to the Super Bowl, and they would lose horribly, always. I mean, beyond losing. So they were always really second best. And after John Elway, which was the quarterback at that time, he won at the very last year of his retirement. He finally won a Super Bowl ring. And it was kind of exhilarating for me. For what reason, I don't really know why. Why do I care that a really rich guy gets a Super Bowl ring and his life is now a storybook? But for some reason, I was really, really excited. And so I started asking myself, well, what do I care for? It's like, well, I didn't after that. I didn't care about football, and I don't care about football right now. Or I guess I'm probably more so indifferent, which is worse. But let's move on. So essentially, the point of all of that is we don't really know why certain images, certain things kind of affect us. We don't know why we're a Republican, why we're a Democrat. I mean, a lot of people don't really investigate. Well, why do I like these things? I don't know. So some other stuff. Anyway, so the shirt thing is all about more about all of these right circumstances came together of all the possibility of shirts I could have possibly have worn. That all just kind of came together, and that was the thought came into my head. Well, that's how people are convicted of crimes they didn't commit. Things all come together. Things you wouldn't think would, but it so happens that it does. So then I started to think, well, maybe that's not an original thought, because the night before, we had driven over to my brother's house, and on television was a movie called Shawshank Redemption, and that, of course, is about a man who was convicted of a crime he didn't commit. So maybe that subtle cue is somehow what brought me to the idea of how people are committed or convicted of crimes they didn't commit. So my brother had just sprayed his house for moths, and he was kind of freaking out because there was a lot of poison in the house or whatever, and we said, it smells fine, it's fine. So as we're leaving, there was one moth fluttering around, and you just kind of got kind of crazy and very upset. Like, this moth, I thought I killed you. So it's like, no, it's just a moth. He's probably going to die soon. Don't worry about it. But then we drove home, and as I'm getting out of the car in our driveway, fluttering around is a moth in our car. And so at that time, that moth is not just a moth now. That moth is more Moby Dick and Ahab. The image or that now has all of this other meaning that is now attached to it. Personally. So, speaking of moths, I was watching the Biography Channel, and they had a special on Silence of the Lambs, and it was just a behind-the-scenes look at how these things come about, the decisions, the casting decisions that are made. And originally up for the role of Hannibal Lecter was Gene Hackman, Dustin Hoffman. Meg Ryan was one of the choices for the Clarice character. And so started to imagine, can we imagine Hannibal Lecter as anything other than Anthony Hopkins? He is a horror icon. And I don't think you can. You can't really imagine that character played by anybody else. Not to say that Dustin Hoffman or Gene Hackman aren't great actors, because they are. But we'll never know, because the movie was made. It was successful. Anthony Hopkins was sort of like last on the list of who wants to play Hannibal Lecter. So even if we were to do a science experiment of some sort and say, let's remake Silence of the Lambs and let's put Dustin Hoffman in it and let's see what would happen, it would sound preposterous, but maybe it would be great. Probably it wouldn't, only because it's in relation to what had already been done. So it brings me to another question, which is, what color is Frankenstein? Anybody know? Anybody care? Green.
Black and white.
Black and white. There you go. That's that. Yeah. So he's green, but actually he's Caucasian, because Frankenstein is the scientist, and there's no such thing as other than the scientist, as Frankenstein, as we know it. It's really Frankenstein's monster. But because somehow, somewhere, we see an icon of Frankenstein, and in actuality, his makeup was done by a guy named Jack Pierce, who designed him as having a flat head, all sort of reasons why he has a flat head. It's bolt, or the strips on his head to access his brain. His fingers are black because of lividity. And he really investigated what it was to be a corpse, or what happens to a corpse as it decomposes. And of course, some giant shoes on Boris Karloff. So he's green because essentially that color shows up really well on black and white film. We don't really know if Jack Pierce said, well, I'm going to paint him green because he's a ghoul, because it references death. In some way, it might. Why not red? Why not more realistic purple or whatever? But simply as utilitarian, he's green because Jack Pierce said, this color shows up better on camera. So somehow, somewhere, this image, this icon, spirals out of control. And now that we know as Frankenstein is that image of that guy with a bolt in his neck, but not really having very much to do with the book as far as design wise. And I'm not arguing that things should always be about the book, or things, there can't be other interpretations other than the book. But The character in the book doesn't ever refer to himself as Frankenstein, or he has never is referred to himself as Frankenstein. He refers to himself as only the new Adam. And he looks much different, and he certainly isn't green. So, sort of like, the legend of Sleepy Hollow, we all imagine that character with a flaming pumpkin on his head, I think. Is that true? But if you ever read the book, he's not even in it. He's only barely referenced, and a pumpkin is not on his head. In fact, at the end of the story is more about mythology and how a town starts to believe in something that they've never seen, nobody's ever seen. It's just a story, and how that just sort of drives a town to paranoia. Or it's also about dating outside of your class. If you're a lowly school teacher, don't date the rich girl who has a really big boyfriend. And I think in the end, a pumpkin, maybe, is smashed, and that's it. But now, as you'll see and you'll notice that there is, let's go over here, change of pace. You'll see that image a lot, and maybe it was a Walt Disney picture that actually was the one that propagated that. I don't know. So if you look at a movie called Unforgiven, that's one of my experiences with Vernon. Two experiences, actually, when I was in school, was my painting. I don't know, what are they, 1,000 classes or something, very, very lowly. I made paintings about corn dogs and very pop art, I guess. And the one thing he said to me was, are you a pop artist? And I kind of took that as a compliment. I was like, well, maybe I am. That would be great, wouldn't it? But I didn't think he meant that. So imagine that these paintings kind of sucked, to be honest with you. And he said, in that moment, he could have said, well, you know, you should really brush up on your typing skills, because you don't have this, you're not going to be able to make it in this career. And I think he actually did say that sometimes in class. But he said, you need to do more. And that was probably fair enough. But where am I going with that? I have no idea. Oh, and another thing he said is one time in hybrid arts class, he said, have you all seen that movie Unforgiven? And I said, to myself, of course, because I never spoke in class, and obviously I'm painfully shy. So he said, it was a great movie. And it rattled off why it was good. And in my head I was saying, yes, that's why I like you, and that's why I like Unforgiven. Because Unforgiven is a movie, it's a Western, it's a classic icon, starring Clint Eastwood. It's about redemption, it's about a lot of things, but in the end, it's about a old killer changes his ways from the love of a woman, and then eventually is forced into having to become an assassin again, become his old self again. And the reason why that movie is really successful is because it is Clint Eastwood, and Clint Eastwood references Clint Eastwood as a cowboy in all of his movies, spaghetti westerns, and interpretations of the West that aren't really even by American film directors, spaghetti westerns. So Clint Eastwood would have to say, if he was casting himself, and say Clint Eastwood as the director, starring Clint Eastwood, old Clint Eastwood came in, from Magnum Force, maybe, or from the Fistful of Dollars series, he would probably say, you're not right for the part. even though you're me. Because the point is that he was old. He was demythologizing. Is that the right word? He was demythologizing himself, saying this is really not what Westerns are. Westerns are more realistic. They're about killing, and that's a terrible thing, I guess. Let's go over here. So, look at the art. I was reading a book the other day about World War I, and that's one of my favorite wars to read about for some reason. I don't know why I like it. There was these soldiers talking about an image of running across a dead soldier in no man's land. And there was a cat on its chest, on the soldier, the dead person's chest, eating his face. And that's a very horrifying image. But what makes it even more horrifying, because you would expect that out of rats. That's what rats do. They're scavengers or whatever. All the connotations that rats are. But it was a cat. And so they tried to shoo the cat away. And the cat, instead of running away, scaredy cat, arched up its back and went. It was scary because it was a cat, not a rat. And for other reasons. So if you've seen a movie called The Road, which is an apocalypse movie, essentially, but there's one particular scene, it's a Cormac McCarthy book, and there's one particular scene where the kid, who was born after the apocalypse, he knows nothing of humanity beforehand. He only knows misery and wandering and trying to survive. There's a image, or there's a scene where the kid, they find an old Coca-Cola in an old vending machine. And they take it out, you know how you used to steal them, and they crack it open, it's dirty, and it's dented, and it's nasty, and he has no idea what it is, but the father does. It's Coca-Cola, everybody knows what that is, and it comes with all of these connotations. It's a treat, and that's what he says to the kid. Go ahead, try it, it's a treat. And he opens it up and drinks it. Says it sparkles. He didn't even know. He had no reference. So that's how now that Coca-Cola is more of a symbol, rather than maybe we might say it's a symbol of corporate or Western culture or whatever kind of nonsense you want to come up and sort of say Coca-Cola is horrible as a corporation and all of those other meanings that are attached to that. But in that time, that was stripped down to just a Coca-Cola. It was a treat. It was somehow meaning that now this is what it means to sort of be a human again, or a kid. And so that film, they wander around and they essentially it's a zombie movie. The director and the writer of the book has taken out all potential sources of food, so there's no, you can't go out and hunt. So essentially it turns everyone realistically into cannibals, into things that we ordinarily wouldn't think we'd ever become. So there's a device used in zombie films, which is we always need to get somewhere. We always, even though there's zombies chasing us, wanting to eat our brains, and why brains, we don't know, because they didn't always eat brains. Sometimes they just ate body parts, but eventually somewhere in the 80s it became brains for some reason. Don't know why. Maybe, well, there's probably reasons why. There definitely is. But anyways, so in the end, they're trying to go, where are we going? We're going south. We're going to go to the coast. That's just an arbitrary thing. And usually in zombie pictures, there are, come with me, there are usually points where well, there's a goal to be had. We want to get to the coast because there'll be some sort of military base. There'll be some sort of food there. Something will be better. It'll be okay. And when they get there, there's nothing. There's just an empty coast with dirty water, and the situation is exactly the same. But because the device has been used beforehand, because we know that somehow, and maybe overtly and subconsciously, that zombie pictures contain that element, then we say, well, let's take that element away in the end. Let's say they don't get anywhere. And so that makes that image even more so powerful because of all of the movies that were made before it that you don't maybe not even realize. So when you look at a picture of a nuclear explosion or an atom bomb, that's not just an atom bomb. It's a black and white atom bomb. It's not the day after atom bomb. It's not the one that scared the hell out of Reagan. It's an old one that has connotations to World War II. And then World War II has connotations all on its own. And then it spirals out of control till everything is just this huge snowball that you roll down a hill. And this information is packed in these things. Even the colors are there. The juxtaposition, the casting director inside the artist says, I'm going to put this against this, and therefore it will somehow evoke a particular mood or feeling. So, I guess here's an example. I brought this apple for you today. This apple is a good pie apple, maybe. And if you say that it's a biblical reference, you would be right. But it's an apple, but it's also a biblical reference. So when you see an apple in a painting, that could mean that. You wouldn't be wrong to say so. And specifically, it means Adam and Eve. And then, if you put, if I can find them, these bolts into it, sorry to drip juice on the floor, now you have a reference to the new Adam, which is Frankenstein. Thank you. Enjoy the show. Anybody want to talk about anything? Maybe that'll go better.
I want to bring up the, did you think about the fact that, did you think about that? That the people that might not be here would be actually maybe watching a football game? Anyway.
It didn't occur to me. Maybe that's a good thing.
Another thing of chance. And one of those people is quite likely Vernon.
Right.
Which is another element of chance. I just think that's kind of interesting.
Right. I mean, these paintings are, there's something very different about a chalkboard. A chalkboard evokes a lot of things to people. To me, it evokes humiliation. It means being forced to get in front of people and show your worth and your knowledge. But then it also means science. It means frustration when it's erased. It means trying to work things out, or it means madness sometimes. It means a lot of things, and especially if it's all the marks are intelligible and you can read them, is another, or it's different than a dry erase board. That means something, maybe technology or whatever, you know. The nuclear bomb means technology gone awry. Who knows? You can make these connections. But in the end, when you're looking at things, try not to maybe, one way to look at it It's just to see what the images evoke, because the artist's job is to pick things. They're professional pickers, they're professional shoppers, or younger people might say, DJs. You select music because it does certain things, you know. Tarantino picks John Travolta as the Pulp Fiction character, not by mistake, not because he needed a job at the time, but probably because he was Vinnie Barbarino, because he was... who's the other? The dancing guy, right? So that was important, and it makes a sense that, well, this is ironic. You don't expect him in this role, but then it also makes it incredibly creepy, and it adds something that because he has this history, therefore this is the appropriate choice. So there's a painting technique which is glazing. And it's not necessarily using a color out straight out of the tube and painting red. It's more of translucent colors that go on top of each other and layer on top of each other and layer and layer and layer. And so therefore, in the end, you get more of a translucent, not so much a red color. It could be kind of slightly purple. It could be kind of brown. But it encompasses a whole lot of things. And when you start putting images on top of images on top of images, then it starts to become something far more obscure. But maybe it evokes or more interesting, I guess.
So the greater complexity, the more...
Sometimes, and then sometimes you can be too complex, and then you can be too obtuse. And I think that when we were in school, they said, you need to build a bridge for an audience. Because remember that an artist is an entertainer. You're here to be entertained, you can watch movies and get some huge philosophical meaning out of it, and then that could bring you to some other idea that, you know, will bring you eventually to another idea. So if you look at these paintings, you know, Gene Hackman's in here, Dustin Hoffman's in here, Kevin Bacon. So there, it's a connection, it's a spider web. So, the bridge is something that you have to build a bridge that someone you can get from point A to point B. Not necessarily maybe not to point B, let's just say that, just a bridge that you can walk on. Sometimes there's highways and information and images are just way too loaded to this or that, and you can't think of anything other than sort of a dead deer. So... And you can use that to your advantage. You can play on that. You say a hamburger and scorpions, right? Okay, well, that doesn't make sense. But scorpions are things that people eat. A hamburger is something people eat, but they're just separated by culture. But, you know, because we know French fries go with hamburgers, therefore it's odd to have a side of scorpions. So the artist is always choosing things. There's an infinite amount of decisions, and it's just not about the imagery. It's a landscape. You can say, well, why did you choose this tree? Why did you use this pine tree? Why not an aspen tree? An aspen tree means a film festival or something great or whatever. It means a whole bunch of different things. You know, why that sunset? Why is the sun there? Why is that there? And this is where the artist as a scientist starts making all of these formulas together. And it brings you to more questions, usually. Or at least I believe, in my opinion, that that's the mark of a really good piece of artwork, is that you don't go, okay, well, this is this, I get it, move on. It's about, well, what does the piece of work do after you've left, after it's gone? Does it make you think about other things? Kong, for example. Man, that's a gorilla, and it climbs in Empire State Building, and he gets shot by airplanes. But really, it's more, if you want to go and be curious and investigate it even more so, you can say that it's about slavery. It's about other cultures usurping other cultures. It's about, you know, all kinds of unpleasant things that you want to talk about. So it's not just a movie about a monkey. It's about the black savage taking the white woman, or whatever, however you want to do it. But any other questions?
How do you make the references? Like you said one time that I was in an art class, and I was automatically the one that. client responded to that. So
exactly.
To me, to see when you're referencing a closed audience or when you identify an image that's a larger than, you know, when you pick an image, are you speaking to people you know you're speaking to, or do you intentionally try to go outside of that circle?
You assume that everyone has heard that. If not, it falls flat. So, which is the choice that you choose, the artist chooses, or a filmmaker or anybody, you choose imagery and you hope. You can choose Frankenstein. Everyone's seen Frankenstein. You know that for a fact. But there's other objects that you kind of just have to roll the dice. And you say, I hope somebody will get this. To me, particularly, the color red evokes this. I'm hoping that if I put it in the right combinations of other things, that it'll evoke this certain emotion. And it doesn't necessarily, yes, I'll just leave it at that. Another question?
Do you think the artist controls everything in the creation?
Absolutely not.
Right,
no.
Subconsciously, the choice of asking people, one of you did like that tree, you have to go there, you saw that tree.
Right, that's absolutely true. That some of it is subconscious, some of it's intuitive, some of it is just because you like that, because somewhere back in the day you climbed an aspen tree and got a coconut off of it, or whatever. But it's true. There, in some cases you can read, and it's always good to sometimes, if you want to read the director or listen to the director's commentary on a movie. But you're going to watch the movie first. You should always look at the painting first and come up with your own conclusions. Because first of all, if you actually, you know, some people write really amazing things about the work and it makes you enjoy it. But it's not to say that what your interpretation, it could confirm what your suspicions are. It could be completely opposite to what you're saying. They're smart people for the most part, but sometimes they're wrong. Even in interviews with an artist, you could say, well, this work is about this. Well, that's suspect too, depending on how he was feeling that day, depending on if he's censoring himself. And sometimes meanings get attached to paintings, usually attributed after the fact. Who knows, he could be in a discussion somehow and somebody says, a friend says, you know, this painting's really about blah, 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 okay. And then therefore the artist starts to believe that that painting was about that too. And then from there on, time immemorial, that painting becomes about that. Frankenstein becomes green. Any questions? More?
I just want to ask you about the way you started and how you got here today. Is that in any way... Is that just a natural process to you? Is that the way you look at art, the way you make art, these conversations sort of growing?
Yeah, I think, well, it's unnatural to speak about it because I make images. So therefore, you know, it's difficult. But a lot of this stuff is art theory that I'm not really familiar with. I don't know semiotics and all of these things and stuff that they were trying to teach in school. But a lot of philosophy is intuitive. You know, it's just, if you start thinking about things, next time you're watching TV or whatever you're doing, go look at the grass. You can see, you can make, you start, if you feel comfortable enough to start making connections, to actually not feel like an idiot, you know, and you have the permission to say what the hell you want, because in the end, that is what an artist's job is. It's like, hopefully I've done my job, I put something out there, and I want it to do something. The worst thing you could possibly do is stand in front of a piece of artwork and say, I'm indifferent, I don't care, I don't find this interesting enough to give it my time. But some things are really, really complicated. There are tons of images. There's so much stuff to look at. And the connections are just infinite of where you can go with it. And that's kind of entertaining to some extent. Daunting, but entertaining. So, making art is a tough job. You know.
Yeah, you know, it's disconcerting to me to believe that artists don't go where they're told.
It's very disconcerting to make art. Because you, in the end of it, have to put something forth and say that you have some sort of authority. And it's oftentimes really difficult to say, I don't know how this happened. But you did somehow. You chose the infinite amount of decisions that you can make in the process. I want to choose this color versus this color. I want to use this technique. This is kind of brushy. Looks kind of airbrushed. Who knows? It's probably not that. But those are the decisions that you're making. You don't always, in fact, that's probably a hindrance, is to always have to think, this has to be the grand statement. Grand statements are usually kind of, or really good things are real subtle. There's a painting in my house. It's a print, actually, and it's above a fireplace. And it's not really a fireplace. It's a gas heater with an attachment with nothing attached, because I've just never bothered to do it. So it's sort of a metaphor for uncuriosity or lack of curiosity and failure. So above that, there is a painting. It's a Goya painting, and I've carried it around. It's a print, actually, a print of a painting. I tried to buy one once, but I didn't have nearly enough money. Anyways, so there's a little child in front of, it's a weird, strange-looking kid with sort of a red jumpsuit and a frilly collar of the time period and a bowl cut, you know, kind of hilarious. He looks like a little porcelain doll, and there's a bird cage behind him, and there's some cats over here, and what he has is a bird on a string, or a gold chain more specifically. So I always liked that painting. I always thought it was, you know, I liked it, it's great. But I don't know why I liked it. Maybe it's because I stole it from my dad, you know, who got it in Germany, and who in the 60s, and all the other times that every time I moved, I hung that painting up, and it was in a frame that was, you know, kind of crappy on this crappy landscape, and I just spray adhesive it over it. And I've never changed it since, because sometimes it peels down and reveals the landscape, which is kind of interesting and irritating at the same time. But anyway, so the child is, I could never figure out. It's a whole bunch of things, reasons why I like that, you know, to get into it. But I said, you know, I like this painting. My brother Chris, where are you? There's my brother. He came over and said, yeah, that is a great painting, and let me tell you why. And then I was like, no, be quiet. I have gone to school for this. I know why this is a great painting. I just haven't gotten to it yet. But he said, you see those cats in the background? That's the son of a king. He's holding a bird, and those cats want to eat the shit out of that bird. But they won't, because he's so esteemed and such a high power, they won't do it. And so, yes, that's what it's about. You know, it's about the images that this guy has picked, rather than say, well, let's just paint a crown on him and a scepter. But we'll, and how can we make that more interesting? Cats, bird on a string, cage, moody painting, creepy-looking child, all kinds of, the formula gets kind of complicated. And you miss things because you're always trying to look for something else.
So does he just start, you know, like put up wrappings and then combine the picture later? Or?
I don't know.
No,
no, no. What's that?
Have you seen Brendan Fisher?
No.
Anybody seen
him? Probably. Some people have an inside knowledge. He, and like I said, you know, he could possibly say, you know, he could tell you how it works, how he does it. And that has some meaning, I guess. It's kind of interesting. But in the end, it's the painting. It's, that's, all of those things of how he works is what's make, trying to make the painting work. And if it, if you respond to it, then it's successful, I guess.
Well, it's sort of like a magic trick, you know, you want to see how it's done.
And that's funny, because there's white rabbits. Magic trick.
Yeah. Well, you made a connection.
But you did make that connection, in a way.
You're probably better at speaking.
No, no. You got it. I mean, you got it. There's a subtle cues. There's cues in there, and they just do things. You don't even know. It, that's in command. You're not. Anything. This is kind of fun now.
Yeah.
thank you so much, Eric. That was.
Thank you.